This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Presented by Fasig Tipton.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The result will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Also sponsored by Windstar Farm. Now here's Mike Penna and Jude Feld.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. It is indeed Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of Backstretch, Pontiff of the Pick Four himself, that is Jude Feld. We are with you again, and a special welcome to everyone joining us throughout North America on Sirius 220 XM Channel 206, and everyone tuning in worldwide with our live streaming on your computer, your smartphone, or your tablet at horseracingradio.net. JT, how are you, my friend? Welcome to another Trainer Talk.
Yeah, this is exciting. We've had a lot of people want to have our guest on Trainer Talk, and we finally got it done.
Yeah, we certainly have. He's been in high demand, and he's in high demand by owners right now as well, because he's really on a roll. He's a native of San Pedro, California. He spent 10 years working as an assistant to the late trainer Mike Mitchell before taking over for Mike in April of 2014. And since that time, he has trained 170 winners. His runners have earned more than $9.1 million in purses, and he's coming off his best year in 2015. He is trainer Phil D'Amato. And Phil, welcome to the program. Happy to have you on Trainer Talk with us tonight.
Thank you, guys. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's been quite a run, and I mentioned your big year last year. You recorded six graded stakes wins and over $5 million in purses in 2015. What was the key to really getting things rolling?
You know, good horses, good owners, and good help. I think you get those three, and you work hard at it. And we've been blessed with some good success last year, and we're going to take that and hopefully build on it and do better this year.
You started out in this game with a little bit of a boost from your mentor, Mike Mitchell, in that you didn't really have to go out and hustle clients. Was it easy for you to keep the people that you had, or did some people say, well, I don't know, maybe I want somebody else to train, even though you'd been with the horses for a while?
Yeah, you know, I was very fortunate in that sense. Most of Mike's owners, you know, I pretty much grew up with through Mike, you know, in the 10 years I worked for him. So they had gotten accustomed to me and comfortable with me, and Mike had some health issues a couple years prior to his passing, where I really kind of took things over and was doing everything day to day, and so when time came, I was just very fortunate that they were all behind me and helped me boost my career forward.
Phil, how did you first become interested in horse racing?
Huh. When I was real little, I would say starting with maybe 9 or 10, my grandfather used to take me to the racetrack. And one day, I'll tell this story all the time, one day he told me, you know, you pick one horse, I'll put $2 to win on it for you. And if the horse wins, I'll give you whatever the horse wins. So I'll never forget, I picked the one horse that day. And it was at 25-1. I got $50. I had enough money to go buy a nice toy, and then I was hooked from there on. And it's funny how the racing gods work. And when I got older, my parents started going into horse ownership and buying horses either through themselves or with various partnerships. And once, you know, that's kind of helped get the juices flowing and things going along, and here I am.
What track did you go to first? Santa Anita, Hollywood?
I Hollywood Park. I definitely know it was Hollywood Park. Was probably the first racetrack I remember being taken to, and then Santa Anita, and usually those two were my hubs there, and I really didn't get to experience much further than those two. Actually, when I was later, probably in my teens, was probably the first time I got to go to Del Mar, and then fell in love with Del Mar, and a lot of fond memories.
Phil, you received your education at USC. You have a major in political science. What was your parents' reaction when you told them that you wanted to train horses for a living?
You know, they were very supportive. I mean, they knew I liked the sport. You know, I was going to go to law school, but I just knew, you know, I'd be at best an okay attorney. So they knew this is where my passion was, and they fully supported me, really, you know, and I owe a lot, if not everything, to their support. And it's a tough game to get going early on and starting at the very, very bottom and working your way up. Fortunate for me, when I graduated from USC, I went to the University of Arizona, the racetrack program. And I went through their equine science department. After that, I was catapulted to work back east for a couple of years. And I think doing that and experiencing all the tracks back east and then in the Midwest, or most of them, that was, invaluable. I couldn't pay enough to have that kind of education.
Yeah, you spent some time working with our good friend Chuck Simon, a former assistant to the late, great Alan Jerkins. What was that like working with Chuck?
Oh, it was great. I mean, you know, working back east and working on the West Coast, it's apples and oranges. It's much more hard-nosed over there, and I think that kind of helped me mold my work ethic. I work 7 days a week, as do most of everybody on the East Coast, I'm sorry, and in the Midwest. And when you're doing that and you're in the grind, you're learning more, you know, and you're digging deep. And I think all those things are the tools you need to help, you know, be a good horseman. You know, you have to have great work ethic. You have to show up every day. You know, you want to take a day off. Yeah, I'll take an afternoon off or something like that. But all those little details, you know, those are the things that can help your horse, you know, by a couple of lengths and get him in the winner's circle. So.
I think the other thing that really helps you when you go back east is the availabilities of all the racetracks and the different spots and the condition book reading. And California is such an island, and you know, you really are stuck there as far as spots are concerned, and even more so today with fewer racetracks open. I mean, there's not a lot of variety or opportunity to go other places, but when you work back east, there's so many tracks that you can enter your horse in, and no matter what track you're at, there's probably three or four within, you know, a couple hundred miles of each other. Do you find that helped you a lot as you read condition books and figure out spots for your horses?
Oh, absolutely. You know, and just kind of just different styles, you know, just watching how East Coast trainers train versus West Coast. It's more stamina driven, slow drills, long gallops, and on the East Coast, and on the West Coast here, everything's more geared towards fast breezes. We want ejected in our horses, and kind of being exposed to all of these different things, I think help. Kind of like you said too, you can you take a West Coast horse with our kind of speed, and you inject that horse in the Midwest or back east on a certain dirt race, and while you might have a half a length lead over here, you might have a 2-3 length lead over there, and vice versa. I think East Coast grass horses are stronger than West Coast, and you gotta know every horse's strengths and weaknesses, and to have those the numbers of horses to be able to play that giant poker game that we play and find the right spots for them. I think that was a big advantage.
So when you approach your business, Phil, and you start training these horses, are you incorporating a little bit of both techniques into your system with the East Coast style and the West Coast style?
Yeah, I think every trainer, kind of formulates their own style, and we still every day try to do something, learn something new. But yeah, I took a lot of what Mike Mitchell taught me, and then I also took stuff from my previous experiences working back east and kind of molded that into my training style. I treat grass horses totally different than I treat dirt horses, and absolutely. And this year, this is going to be the first time. We'll see how it works. I'm going to send a string to Keeneland this year, and I'm going to see how some of my West Coast horses will fit in the Midwest and maybe back east eventually as well, and go from there. But I'm trying to find those right kind of horses that can they might be okay over here, but in a different environment, different pace scenario, they might be much stronger individual at Keeneland or Churchill. So we'll see how that goes.
If you send them to Keeneland, they got to be good. That's the bottom
line. That opening weekend, I'm going to plan to run a couple and some stakes. I'm gonna run Sunday Rules in that Grade One Madsen, and she's another one. I mean, she's got 21-2 speed over here, and she's a length in front. I want to see how that speed formulates or translates to Keeneland. I think my filly will be 2-3 in front, in that race, and they'll have to come get her. But these are things it's going to be trial and error, and we're going to find out.
Talking with trainer Phil D'Amato on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
It'll be nice to have you in our own backyard, so to speak.
I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, we'll have a good time when you're there. The Baffert factor, you mentioned the fast works and stuff, and of course with Bob working his horses very quickly most of the time. Do you think that changes the philosophy that other trainers have in California? Does it force you to kind of work your horses faster maybe than you want to?
Yes or no. I don't think it's so much the Baffert factor as that I think it's the way the tracks are set up here. The tracks are set up here for speed horses to have an advantage and win. It's not like a Belmont Park where it's the big sandy here and horses come from way out of it and win. They just don't over here. And I think it's more, Baffert's attuned to that, and he trains, his horses accordingly. And for you to have a chance, you need to have a horse with some great speed or tactical speed to have a chance in these big races over here.
Phil, you mentioned that you approach training turf horses differently than you do dirt horses. What's the biggest difference in the two types of horses?
With dirt horses, for the most part, we will focus on, putting the speed into them, getting them on the bit, making sure they're sharp and they'll show some speed or tactical speed and they'll train on the main track. And for turf horses, I give them long, slow stamina gallops and drills where, they'll breeze 5/8, 3/4 of a mile, but really they'll be breathing a mile in 38, 39, something, the good ones will do stuff like that. So I just set them up differently.
You also mentioned learning from your former mentor, Mike Mitchell. What are some of the things that Mike taught you?
And I think that's kind of where I've been so great with my grass horses, because I think Mike was an excellent grass trainer. I mean, to me, I watched him train alongside Bobby Frankel for the decade that I was here in California, side by side at Hollywood Park. And I tell you, their training styles were very similar. The only difference was, you know, Bobby had Judmont horses and Mike had 32, 40 claimers that he was trying to make into some Judmont kind of horses. And, but I think that's kind of where Mike's assets or his strengths were definitely claiming those kind of grass horses and putting them into his system, putting the right kind of foundation in them and placing them right. So I've made a lot of nice claims, like a horse like Big John B, and that was the typical Mike Mitchell kind of horse where he would take that horse and, you know, that was a 32-40 claimer, put it in his training regiment, and, you know, all of a sudden they're a stake or a graded stake horse.
Yeah, I think that was a very unique system that Mike had to do that, and he would claim horses that, you know, maybe hadn't even gone much farther than a mile and get them to go, you know, a mile and 3/8, a mile and a half, even the San Juan once in a while. So, you know, that's a real knack to have.
Yeah, and I think for a series of years, we might have won three out of the four San Juan Capistranos or something like that. I mean, Mike definitely had an eye for finding that right kind of a claimer and, you know, just molding them into, a cut above what the other guy did. And they weren't all superstars. We didn't make all the great claims, but the ones that did really stood out and that's what the claiming game's all about.
Phil, what do you remember about the day you came back from the East Coast after working with Chuck and you walked into Mike Mitchell's barn for the first time asking him for a position? What do you remember about that day?
You know, it was really just good timing because he, at that time, I think he had just gotten rid of his longtime assistant and, I stepped in and he really didn't know much about me. And he said, you know, I'll give you, I told him what I did back East. He said, I'll give you a week's trial. And if I don't like you, you'll need to go find the job somewhere else. And he put it as blunt as that. And, after day two, he hired me and he said, you know, this is great. Let's roll with it and get going. So, luckily I won him over pretty quickly and we had a great run. So, I owe him just as much as he was like a second father to me at the racetrack. I mean, he would take me out to dinners. I'd do everything with his family and he just treated me like the son he never had. I owe a lot to him and very grateful that, the reason I'm here is mainly in part of him and his education to me and fortunate to carry his owners and his legacy.
Well, there's no doubt that Mike will be missed, not just on the West Coast, but in the sport in general. What's your favorite Mike Mitchell story that you like to tell?
let's see, the ones I could tell, you know, I'm trying to think he was so good. He had so many stories. One story he had in terms of gambling. Now, when I worked for Mike, he wasn't big gambling back then. He used to be a guy that would take a big punt or two, you know, back in the day. And, Steve Miotti, one of his other former assistants, he tells it better than I do. But one day, I guess down at Del Mar, I must have been in the early '80s or something like that, where him and Frankel shared. They had adjoining barns actually, and Bobby had kind of felt bad for Mike, and my, you know, Mike had kind of been down on his luck, but Mike would always use the ice machine at Frankel's barn. Bobby would let him use the ice machine for his horses, and there was this horse right next to the ice machine that he'd point his left leg out in front of the stall there, like, you know, like something was bothering him on the up front. But that's just how some of these horses are, and even if they don't have issues, some will just point that leg out there next to the ice machine. And one day Bobby told Mike, you know, hey, I got a horse for you, you know, bet this horse and you'll get out and make a little bit of money. And Mike asked him which horse, and Bobby told him the horse. I don't know the name of the horse. And he said, and Mike goes, is that the horse that points his leg out in front of the ice machine every day? That's the horse you want to give me to bet? Bobby says, don't worry, he'll win. Just bet your money and don't worry about it. So not only did Mike bet the horse, but Mike claimed the horse. And the horse won by like 10 that day. And Mike claimed this, and it kind of, you know, at that time, Bobby had so many horses, 110 claimer didn't matter. But it was like a big stir. Both barns were, you know, were just about to brawl it out over the whole deal. And needless to say, Mike got the horse. Mike said he ran it like 10 times and it never won another race after that. But the day Bobby told him to claim him, he won by 10. But after it took a while for them to become friends again. But that was Mike Mitchell back in the day. I got a lot of other ones, but I think that was the most tame I could tell here.
Yeah, I always wished he had become a lawyer or a butcher or something else other than a horse trainer. I've finished second to him so many times. I've often said I'd probably be in the Hall of Fame if it wasn't for Mike Mitchell. he used to claim horses. He claimed a couple off of me that were very, very strange deals. I claimed a horse one time that hadn't won a race in 3 years, and I stretched the horse out in kind of Mitchell style, and I think he must have seen, you know, the way that I was training this horse, and the horse wins with Shoemaker on San Diego Derby Day, and Mike claimed it. And the horse was 8 years old, and he'd never gone around ground. I'm going, how does somebody claim this horse? And another time down at Del Mar, I had a horse that was, I think, 11 years old. And Mike claimed him off of me. And I go, who claims an 11-year-old?
And he loved to try. That was his angle. He was always like, when we claimed horses, it was, if we claimed them and it ran bad short, oh, don't worry, we'll run them long. And, you know, that was his big angle. He loved to get a horse that was always running short, or, you know, something that he thought that the other guy didn't try that he can improve on. But he loved that angle, the short to long, and put those Mitchell-esque gallops into them and try running them long. So that was one of his fortes.
Phil, you mentioned the claim that you made, and a very good claim, and that might be an understatement, on Big John B. Tell me about some of the best claims that you and Mike made together when you were working with him.
You know, there were a ton of them. We had some really good ones, and you know, for the most part, they were all horses that kind of fit that mold that I was talking about. I mean, we claimed a horse off a Hollendorfer named Symphony Sid that he was well-bred, that I think the Craigs had owned and they gave up on, and Mike put him in his system, and we won the San Luis Rey Stakes, I think, by like a dozen lengths, you know, just trying something that Jerry didn't try. We claimed a horse called On the Acorn for the Disney Brothers In Disguise stable, and he won a bunch of graded stakes for us. You know, Big Booster was another one. Leprechaun Kid. Mike just had so many. Church Service. These were all horses that we claimed and ended up with. Ever a Friend. He was probably my favorite horse. We claimed him off of Christoph Clement, I believe, for 62.5 at Hollywood Park. There were six claims in for him that day, and we just had one slip, and we got him, and we ended up winning the Kill Row Mile with him and some other stakes. But
Mike, even though he had his own system, he treated all these horses like individuals and found their whole card. And, you know, some would love to gallop 2 miles on the training track. You know, others would just love to jog and then breeze like a mile. You know, so that's the one thing about Mike is he was the ultimate horseman in terms of just kind of tailoring a specific training regimen to a horse like that and getting the most out of him. So.
Yeah, I was stable next to Mike for many years, and I always loved watching his action, you know, and how he'd kind of like waddle down the shed row, and it looked like he wasn't really paying attention to anything, but he knew everything that was going on, and he never was afraid to do something avant-garde. I remember one time when he was claiming horses just by the droves, and he didn't have enough stalls, and he'd already been borrowing a couple from me. And I came back one night to check on the horses, and there's two horses in one stall in my barn. He had claimed one, and he didn't have a stall for it, so he just put in with another horse. And I had never seen that before. I go, what the heck's going on? And the next morning, I go, what, did you do that on purpose? He goes, yeah, I didn't have a stall, so I just figured, I hope they get along. But he was wild. He'd do some crazy things sometimes.
It was guest. Great education and excellent horseman, and that's all I can say.
Phil D'Amato here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Phil, we're going to get to a break. We're going to come back and have the second half of the program and look back on some of your career highlights. There have been several since you started training over the past few years. We'll take a look at them next here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. In 2015, the Fasig Tipton selected yearling sales outperformed all major North American yearling sales. The July sale, held in Lexington, Kentucky, is annually a top-ranked yearling sale by percentage of greatest stakes winning graduates and saw 15 sires represented by their highest-priced colt or filly in 2015. The prestigious Fasig Tipton Saratoga sale posted an increased average of over $322,000 while boasting a remarkably low RNA rate of just 15% and was tremendously strong in the middle market with a higher percentage of horses sold in the $100,000 to $300,000 range than book one of the Keeneland September sale. The New York bred sale in Saratoga produced 50 yearlings of $100,000 or higher with an increased average of more than $81,000. The Fasig Tipton selected yearling sales, superior results. Visit FasigTipton.com.
It all started with a dream. A dream to be the best. To breed the best. To race the best.
Super Saver Rossellmeyer, what a finish to the class.
And to stand the best. Windstar Farm, dedicated to the dream.
And they're off to New York. The premier state bred program in the United States. When you own a New York bred, your horse can run for more than $44 million in purses restricted to registered New York breds. And the New York program pays awards to breeders, owners, and stallion owners when their New York breds finish first, second, or third at New York tracks. We have the quality.
Day at the spa, all the way.
You have the opportunity. New York breds, get with the program. The best program.
Being a jockey may be one of the more dangerous professions in all of sports. In a split second, you can go from the top of the standings to never being able to stand again. I'm Mike Penna, and over the years, I've had the privilege of talking with many of the top jockeys in thoroughbred racing. And to a person, they will tell you that on any given day, before any given race, when they get a leg up, there's no guarantee they'll return the way they left. It's simply the reality of being a jockey. The Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund does amazing work, providing financial assistance to some 60 former jockeys who have suffered catastrophic on-track injuries.
Since its founding 10 years ago, the PDJF has disbursed over $7 million to permanently disabled jockeys. And I'm proud to say that the PDJF is the official charity of the Horse Racing Radio Network. But the only way they can continue helping those disabled riders who have given our sport so much is through your generosity and support. So I encourage you to visit pdjf.org and start making a difference today.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Coming to the top of the lane, an unbridled command, the leader, but here comes Big John B. And Big John B is now striding up to take on unbridled command at the top of the lane. They turn for home. And it is Big John B gone right on by, just getting the rein shaken him. He's drawn clear now. And from here on in, it's just a matter of how far Big John B and Mike Smith turning it into a procession. They romping in. Close for second, Bright Thought, late run from Benchlight, but it all belongs to Big John B. Benchlight second, then Bright Thought.
Big John B. He could not have been more impressive in winning the 2014 Del Mar Handicap. Trevor Denman with the call. That was the first of two consecutive victories in the race for Big John B. And he, of course, is trained by our guest here on Trainer Talk this evening. That is trainer Phil D'Amato. And looking forward to the second half of the program. We will remind you that if you missed any portion of the show, go back to our website, horseracingradio.net. You can check out a podcast of this show and all of our Trainer Talk shows. It's all there for you, horseracingradio.net and Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. I thought you might like that little rejoin clip there, JT.
Yeah, well, my longtime client, Michael House, there's nobody better to train for, huh, Phil, than Mr. House? He's a great client. Did we lose Phil?
He must not think he's all that good of a...
he understands the highs and lows of this game, but excellent to train for. He always lets me do what I want, and we talk about our options after that, he's super, super guy.
Phil, you had really just started on your own with the Mike Mitchell horses as you won that Del Mar Handicap. It was your third greatest stakes victory. You had a quote in the Blood Horse before that race, and I want to read it to you. You said, "If you'd have told me at the beginning I'd have already won the stakes races I have, I would have definitely second-guessed that." How come?
You know, at that time, I inherited a couple of stake horses, but most of my horses were kind of blue collar kind of horses at that time. And, I decided I had some horses where I was game for taking shots with, and some stakes, something Mike might not have been so comfortable going through for. Conditions, but when a horse is doing really good, that's the time to strike and take a shot, and you can always go through your conditions after that. And it just so happened, like, every time I would take a shot with in a stake race, for the most part, I'd come up smelling like roses. So I just very fortunate. I had a great team behind me, and I was just rolling with it.
Well, that's the key a lot of times, is knowing how good a horse is on any given day, and they have a tendency to tell you.
Yeah, absolutely. And that goes to having great help behind you and making sure all the details are being taken care of, and being at the barn 7 days a week and kind of in tune with your horses. I think all those things help. Being here at feed time, all those things where you go come here at 3 o'clock on a Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and see how many trainers are here at feed time. The guys that want to win races, they're the ones here. The other guys that are doing something else, those are the guys that are, I think, nothing against it, and I wouldn't mind doing it myself, but But that's kind of how you have to be in tune with your horses, I think, to be successful.
Yeah, and speaking of that, Phil, you mentioned your help and your team that you're surrounded with, and nobody does this on their own. Let's face it, there's a lot of moving parts when you're training horses. You made the decision that you were going to keep most of Mike Mitchell's personnel when you took over full-time, didn't you?
Yeah, and that helped tremendously. I mean, I've got grooms working for me that were with Mike for 25 years, you know, and all that experienced help, experienced grooms, exercise riders, assistants, foremans. I've inherited that and built upon that. And that's your backbone. Without great help, you know, you're like they say, you're only as good as your help. And been very, very fortunate with that. I'm working alongside some really good horsemen.
What would you consider to be your biggest challenges or the biggest hurdles you've had to overcome so far since going out on your own?
You know, I think just being able to continually find horses to compete at the top level. I think that's what I've been working on, and I've got great owners that have helped me achieve that, and I think more and more my barn's getting is being filled up with allowance stake horses as opposed to claimer allowance horses, and I think the more you can build your barn and get those better horses, the better chances you're going to have of being able to win the big races, you know, and that's kind of the biggest challenge, and that's why all these trainers were all going to be, you know, at the 2-year-old and training sales and at the various sales. Even I go to Tattersall's in England and in Ireland looking for Euros as well. So it's just always trying to find the best, you know, the next best horse. And you got to have great owners that support you money-wise and then be able to deliver once you do get that kind of horse.
Yeah, it's a tough racket to get clients. It's especially hard, I think, in California because of the fact that it's such a small racing community there. But it's also a very expensive game, so you have to have those horses that compete at the higher level in order to, you know, keep the bills paid.
Absolutely, and you know that's the thing. You know, when you want a dirt horse, that's fine. You're going to have to find something that's going to compete with the $500,000, $600,000, $700,000, $800,000 horse that you know Bob bought 100 times over, you know, in his barn. And you know what though? But it's just been shown. Look at California Chrome. Look at all these horses. If you work hard enough and do your due diligence, you can find a horse for $50,000, $100,000, $150,000 that can compete with those high dollar horses, you know, all the time. So that's kind of what it's all about. Just shaking every tree and you know, even cowbreds. They have a great program here in California, a great program with a lot of money behind it, and finding good cowbreds can make you just as much money as if you found a good, you know, Kentucky bred.
So what's the Phil D'Amato philosophy for picking out the right horse when you go to the sales? What are you looking for, Phil?
You know, at the 2-year-old and training sales, Mike Mitchell was really big on just going to the previews blind. Don't look at the book. Look at the individual. You look at the individual first, see how they breathe, see how they travel. And then if you like that horse, you know, circle it. Then go to your book. And then, you know, don't let the pedigrees influence you, basically. Because so many times you go through these, especially the 2-year-old in training sales, and you'll do it in reverse. Oh, I don't like this sire. I don't like that sire, this dam. And, you know, that's fine and dandy, but look for the athlete first. Then go and see how much that, you know, athleticism compares with their pedigree. Where, you know, hey, I've never seen a anything by that sire do well. You know, then maybe you cross that off. But look at the athlete first and let that influence you before you let the pedigree influence you.
Yeah, it's so important to have those athletes. And of course, it depends, too, on the sales you're going to. That might be what you do at a two-year-old sale. But, like, when you go to Europe, do you employ a team over there? Do you go yourself? How does that work when you're looking for ready-made horses?
Yeah, no, for there, I'll definitely work with a couple different bloodstock agents. And that game is totally different. You've got to compete with international money. And to a guy, you know, looking for a horse to go run in the Dubai Carnival, a horse to us, you know, with certain conditions might only be worth $150,000. But if to them, that same horse might be worth $500,000 or more. So you've got to kind of check through a whole different set of variables when you go to those sales. But mainly, you know, when I go to Europe, I want a horse that definitely has his conditions to work through and build confidence in the States. To buy a horse that's won 4 over there and has gone through his conditions, you better be buying a graded stake horse off the plane or else you're going to be in trouble. You know, so a lot of different variables go into those different sales. But the thing of it is you need horses from those different sales to kind of fill all the gaps in your barn. You need the grass horses, you need the young dirt horses, and you've got to be attuned to all these different sales and even privately, just so you can build a diverse barn to have a chance to compete at the top level.
Well, Phil, you're no stranger to competing at that top level. You have won a couple of years, a couple of grade ones to your credit as well. You've been to the Breeders' Cup. You were there in 2014 with obviously and Big John B. That was your first Breeders' Cup experience. Tell me about that and having those horses run in your name and saddling them in the Breeders' Cup.
That was very special. Obviously he's definitely the barn favorite. He's definitely one of my favorites. He's 8 years old, and when I run him, he runs just as hard as he did when he was 4 years old. You know, he'll run those 105, 106 buyers and just lay it down. I mean, to have a horse that special, and a lot of credit has to be given to those owners, Joe Scardino and Tony Fanicola. They totally believe in the horse, and whatever that horse needs or however much time that horse needs to have, they give it. And, you know, he might only run 5 or 6 races a year, but he makes it worth their while when he does. And that's the other thing is I've been very fortunate to have all my owners are great owners that let me decide when the horse needs time off, let me decide, you know, when – what kind of spots we should pick and choose. And those things all play big factors when horses are kind of get a little sour on you and some guys are forced to have, you know, owners make them run in spots that they don't want to run in. And then kind of just makes everyone look bad when the horse performs poorly. But that's the thing is to be able to have that ability and control to give them a little break when they need it and freshen them up and refire off the bench.
That's a great luxury for a trainer to have, a client that's willing to give horses time like that. And those guys, Scardino and Fanticola, they've been in the business a long time, and a lot of times that's the key to owners understanding the game a little bit more.
Absolutely. And those owners that have been in the game a long time. And again, I've been blessed with all of Mike's longtime owners and some new ones of my own. And just the ability to kind of pick and choose to spot them in the right spots and to have the ability to freshen them up when they need to be freshened up or always adds to their longevity and your success in the afternoons.
Yeah, those old-time clients, they can actually help your younger ones understand the game and support you as a trainer when, neophyte owners have crazy ideas. But the older clients, if your clients mix with one another and have discussions, the older ones can chill the younger ones out a little bit.
It's great. That's another good thing with my owners is a lot of them know each other and converse Joe Scardino, he's the patriarch. He loves to kind of mentor the younger ones and tell them through his experiences, you know, what to do and what not to do, basically. So.
Visiting with trainer Phil D'Amato here on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Of course, Phil has trained several graded stakes winners in his brief career. He really is on a roll, as you've heard throughout this program here this afternoon. Phil, I guess the obvious question is, coming back to something you mentioned in the first half of the show, you talked about the dedication it requires to be good at this sport, and you said, look, I don't take a lot of days off. If I'm going to take a day off, it might be a half a day, for example. What is it about training horses that becomes such a passion for those that decide to pursue this particular profession?
You know, it's just something that gets in your blood, you know, and once it's there, I mean, this has been my passion again since I was a little one. And it's just like anything. Once you're passionate about it and you want to be the best at something, you give it your all, you know. And I think I've been very fortunate where that given my all, it's kind of helped propel me along with my opportunities. And, hopefully it shows for years to come.
What's the price of Phil D'Amato getting in the Hall of Fame?
What's that again?
What's the price of Phil D'Amato getting in the Hall of Fame?
Oh, you know, that's one thing I don't. I kind of put that aside. I just want to develop my horses and do the most with what I have, and for them to realize their fullest potential. And if I can do that, then everything's been complete in what I've tried to do for my career.
Phil, I've just gone ahead and followed you on Twitter. As a young guy, you're only in your, late 30s. Do you find that social media is something that you use quite often to help you maybe acquire clients or to keep in touch with your current clients?
They like it. My younger clients, they like, you know, the Twitter posts and all that stuff. And I'm actually developing a website now to kind of, if my owners want to go up there and kind of be updated on their horses, probable race dates and workouts and all that. I'm setting that up and that's close to launching. But yeah, no, I think all that stuff definitely helps, you know, with your owners, the ones that are, you know, and also prospective owners as well.
Tell me about the picture you have as your profile picture on Twitter.
That was a long time ago when I was a lot skinnier. but that's actually on the Acorn. I think that's when we won the Jim Murray handicap, I believe. I think it was like a 6-horse field, and Champ Elizaze of Frankel's was like 1-9. And Ramon Dominguez flew in from back east to ride it for Frankel. And sure enough, Mike Mitchell nailed him with on the Acorn right on the wire. And that was a really fond memory because, the Frankel barn didn't think we had a chance, and the underdog prevailed. So I never forgot that winner circle photo, and that's what's on there.
Always been a rivalry between the Mitchell barn and the Frankel barn.
Yeah, no, and in good fun. When I was there too, you know, they were still friends, really good friends, and you know, the the running joke in the barn would always be, you know, Mike would say, you know, Phil, can't we get our horses to look like Bobby's horses? And, you know, after everyone would laugh, and he'd say that for, you know, to his help for when I was before that, you know, there. But, we always said, Mike, you know, those are Judmont million-dollar horses, and these are horses we claim for 25 or 32, trying to make them look like that. Sometimes it works, sometimes, you know, it doesn't. But, we always had a good rivalry, but, Bobby's horses were always a cut or two above ours.
Well, if you do want to follow Phil D'Amato on Twitter, you can do it at Phil D-A-M-A-T-O 11, at Phil D'Amato 11. Phil, were there other trainers that you looked up to as a kid when you were thinking about getting involved in racing that you said, man, someday that could be me?
Well, you know, I always used to love watching the Frankel horses and the Neil Drysdale horses. Those were two guys I always followed on the West Coast all the time. And back east, I used to love to watch Shug McGahee's horses, Jerkins' horses. And I think between those, I was always a fan of their training styles and their rivalries. I think that's kind of how I developed my fondness for grass racing early on, and I saw some great races.
So what's it like then for you to walk into the paddock to saddle a horse, and there's Neil Drysdale, maybe Shug McGahee, all these guys that you grew up idolizing, so to speak, and now you're right there, you're one of their peers, and maybe you even beat them on occasion. What's that like?
It's definitely a thrill. Just to watch Neil Drysdale win all those races for decades, and then for me to compete against him and even beat him sometimes, it's a thrill. And we're friends, and that's the fun part about this game and the position I've been put in to compete with definitely people and horsemen that I truly respect, and all respect this wonderful game that we're in, and to, try to win and have fun doing it.
What's on the horizon? What do you got planned coming up? Are you going to be more active at the sales? Are you going to slack off on claiming horses? Or are you just going to keep doing what you're doing?
I'm going to try to develop and get some more nice young two-year-olds and dirt horses prospects in my barn. I've got some nice grass horses, and I'm always looking for more good grass horses. But that's kind of the spot I'm going to try to really work on here in OBS March, April, and at Barrett's over here as well, to try to get some good two-year-olds and see if we can win some two-year-old races later on in the year and develop them into three-year-old classic types.
If you missed the first half of the program, Phil talked about bringing a string to Keeneland this coming April meet. Phil, I know you mentioned there's a little bit of trial and error involved with that. Talk about some of the challenges that are involved when you have a string at a different racetrack, especially one that you're not used to being at.
Oh, just the whole getting the horses over there and getting it set up the way you want it to be set up. But that's kind of, you know, that's par for the course. Keeneland, we're going to probably have 10 or 12 there, just kind of interchangeable, going back and forth from Kentucky to California. And we'll just see how it goes. And if all goes well, I'm planning on extending it through part of Churchill and seeing how that goes as well. But I think to have an extra venue to be able to kind of spread your horses out and maybe pick better spots over in Kentucky versus California, I think that might prove fruitful here this year.
We're down to the final couple of minutes, Phil. It's been a really fun hour. We'll encourage people to go to our website, horseracingradio.net, to check out the podcast. Also, like all of our guests who appear on the program, you receive a gift courtesy of one of our sponsors. That is Flair Equine Nasal Strips. So we'll get your address and have the folks at Flair send those out to you. But before we wrap it up, I always like to end by asking trainers to tell us a little something about them that people might not know. So when you're not at the barns, you're not at the racetrack, what else does Phil D'Amato enjoy doing?
You know, I just have a great time. I've been very fortunate to, we had a foster child for a while, and we're going into a final adoption with him. And to have a little 8-year-old to throw the baseball at and watch him have fun, like, you know, just kind of being a parent, basically. You know, it's just been a very grateful and fulfilling experience for me, and to kind of watch him do all the things I did when I was little. And that's what I do. I like to spend time with my family, and you know, just kind of take a step back and enjoy life. You know, that's kind of being it. Hopefully I'll be a great dad someday and a great trainer, and you know, be very content.
Well, congratulations on that. That's really outstanding, and there's nothing like family, that's for sure. And in our game, you need that support of your family if you're going to be successful.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when you lose a couple, you know, that day when and you go home and everything kind of doesn't seem all that great that day, and you come home and you got a little one running around wanting to play with you and oblivious to, you know, how you did at the races, I mean, that it makes it all worthwhile.
Yeah, yeah. Well said.
My daughters never drew a picture of a horse that was losing.
Well, Phil, we can't thank you enough for being our special guest here tonight. It's been a lot of fun to hear your story, and we'll look forward to catching up with you up the road. But all the best moving forward, and we'll see you soon, my friend.
Thank you so much. I had a great time.
I'm Phil D'Amato here on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton. And JT, just a quick note about the sponsor of this program, Phasic. What a great March Florida sale they had, the 2-year-old training sale. What was it, $4 million horses? And the numbers way, way up, I believe over 44% from last year. Tremendous.
Yeah, we saw some of those horses training earlier in the meeting, and everybody looked good, and it was a great sale. A lot of people came from all over the world, so congrats.
RNAs were down too. Good sale. Congratulations to them, and thanks for all their support of this program. For our producer back in our Lexington studio, that is Lee Delapina. For the pontiff of the Pick Four, Jude Feld, and our special guest, Phil D'Amato, I'm Mike Penna. We'll talk to you next time right here on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton.